Hi, this is Elliot Gould, and you're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara.
Good afternoon, friends. Good afternoon. You're listening now to the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host, Maria Hall. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Jim. Can you hear me okay?
I hear you loud and clear, my dear. I know we've got a good show today. Let our listeners know what it is.
All right. Well, first, we'll be joined by our friend, constitutional law expert Stephen Rohde, who will help us understand some of the recent court decisions, even decisions that came down this week, on the Alien Enemies Act, the National Guard in California, the dismissal of Trump's lawsuit against judges in Maryland, as well, of course, as our ongoing fight for academic and press freedom. And then in the second half hour, we'll be joined by our friend, Matthew Strugar, attorney, who will join us for an update on animal rights laws, as well as on the laws that protect animal rights advocates.
Aha. Well, let's get right in. That sounds like a very full hour to me. And yes, we do have once again on the Lawyers Guild Show, we're going to review court hearings. There's always a lot going on in the courts. But right now, with Trump being Trump, there's all the more interest in the courts, I think, across the journalism in general in this country. You read more about it in the press, in the general press, than you often did in the past. It's where a lot of what Trump is trying to do is being tested out in the courts, win, lose, or draw. And so we are, again, lucky to have with us, as you said, our guest for this, Stephen Rohde. Now, Mr. Rohde is a prolific author, two books and scores of articles and book reviews on constitutional law and history. He's former president of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California. He's special advisor on free speech and the First Amendment to the Muslim Public Affairs Council. He's also a host of the new podcast, Speaking Freely, which is produced by MS Studios. It's available on Spotify, iHeartRadio, and other streaming platforms. And I should mention that Mr. Rohde is also, along with Maria Hall and myself, a host of the national public affairs show, Law and Disorder. Yes, lawanddisorder.org, my friends. I highly recommend you check it out. We're now in the air in close to 200 air markets around the country. So it's proved to be a popular show, and I think you will hear a lot of voices there that you'd like to check out with as well. Well, Steve Rohde, welcome back to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you, Jim and Maria. It's a pleasure in this context to be with both of you.
All right. Well, before we do anything else, within the last hour or so, a federal judge in Massachusetts just ruled that the Trump administration unlawfully cut $2.2 billion from Harvard's research funding. Tell us about this remarkable decision.
Well, just as I was preparing for all the other important rulings we want to discuss today, down came this decision by U.S. District Judge Allison D. Burroughs. In Boston, she issued an 84-page summary judgment ruling. This, of course, was in the lawsuits brought by Harvard and the American Association of University Professors and others, was in response to Trump cutting off $2.2 billion of scientific, medical, technical, cancer, and other research on the pretext that Harvard wasn't doing enough to fight anti-Semitism on its campus. The judge came right to it. She said, quote, "We must fight against anti-Semitism, but we equally need to protect our rights, including our right to free speech, and neither goal should nor needs to be sacrificed on the altar of the other." She found that Harvard was taking reasonable steps to combat anti-Semitism and other forms of hate, but that safeguarding academic freedom and freedom of speech are required by the Constitution, and to ensure that important research is not improperly subjected to arbitrary and procedurally infirm grant terminations, even if doing so risks the wrath of a government committed to its agenda, no matter the costs. The judge vacated Trump's freeze and enjoined the administration from enforcing the freeze on those $2.2 billion in important research. Of course, the case will be appealed, but this is simply one more case of a careful 84-page opinion documenting what is illegal that the Trump administration is doing.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Well, yesterday, also some good news. Here in Los Angeles, we woke up to the fact that Judge Charles Breyer, U.S. District Federal Court Judge Breyer, issued a 52-page opinion in the case called Gavin Newsom versus Donald Trump. After a full trial, Judge Breyer concluded that Donald Trump and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth violated the law when they deployed National Guard forces to Los Angeles. Remember in the June when they did that? Steve, remind us of the facts of the case and what kinds of laws were involved in the decision.
Just a very important decision coming right here in Los Angeles, in your large market at KPFK. The judge found that this deployment of 5,000 Marines and National Guards created a false national police force, which violates the Posse Comitatus Act from the 19th century, which prohibits the use of military forces to enforce domestic laws. President Trump had exceeded the limits of federal laws that prohibit the use of the military for domestic law enforcement. Trump, Hegseth, and the Department of Defense deployed those forces ostensibly to quell a, quote, rebellion and ensure that immigration laws were enforced. And the judge found that indeed there were widespread protests in Los Angeles and some individuals engaged in violence, but there was no rebellion, nor were civilian law enforcement unable to respond to the protests and enforce the law. Trump once again was invoking emergency. Now he's just done it again in Washington, D.C. Yeah. He's threatening to do it in democratically led cities, often with African-American mayors across the country. So this slapdown by Judge Breyer is a very important ruling. The Department of Justice has accused Breyer of being a radical left judge, but instead Breyer's ruling was detailed and documented. The executive order claimed that there were a form of rebellion, and the judge made very clear that it was under control by local authorities and there was no legal basis for Trump and his minions to move in, as everybody in Los Angeles and who watched the news anywhere could see. Of course, the Department of Justice under Trump has called the order misleading, and they said they were simply enforcing the law. But Judge Breyer held a three-day hearing. And I have to mention in closing on this case that Major General Scott Sherman, a 33-year-old Army veteran who led the task force, pointed out that he had objected when the administration wanted to conduct a mission on Father's Day and send troops into MacArthur Park and elsewhere. He considered that inappropriate. And for saying that and giving his best judgment, Gregory Bovino, a Border Patrol chief, called General Sherman disloyal to his country. This is what happens when you stand up to this government. They question your patriotism, even if you're a general in the military. very important decision, sure to be appealed, but well documented and well thought out.
Well, Stephen, yesterday a federal appeals court blocked the Trump administration's use of the controversial Alien Enemies Act, which could otherwise allow almost immediate deportations. So remind us what the Alien Enemies Act is and how the Trump administration has been trying to use it and what the judges decided in this case.
This was a very important case because now we move up from the district court levels in our last two examples to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals that sits in Louisiana and is generally considered a very conservative court. It was a 2-1 decision, and they really went to the heart of the Alien Enemies Act. That act was passed in 1798 during the John Adams administration. It has rarely been invoked. It requires a finding that there has been an invasion or predatory incursion against the United States at the direction of a foreign government. What the Trump administration claimed was that the Venezuelan government was sending the Tren de Aragua, TDA gangs into the United States, and that constituted an invasion or incursion. Well, Judge Leslie Southwick wrote the majority opinion, and she's a George W. Bush appointee. She emphasized that the evidence simply did not support the finding of invasion or incursion. She did say that there may be other statutes or laws that can be used, but those would require due process and the giving of notice and an opportunity to be heard. She was joined in her opinion by Judge Irma Ramirez, a Biden appointee, but a Trump appointee, Andrew Oldham, issued a 131-page dissent demeaning the majority. And here's one quote that I'll finish this case with. That dissenting judge, the Trump appointee, said, "Today the majority holds that President Trump is just an ordinary civil litigant. His declaration of a predatory incursion is not conclusive. Rather, President Trump must plead sufficient facts as if he were a run-of-the-mill plaintiff in a breach of contract case to convince a federal judge that he is entitled to relief." Well, yes, Judge Oldham, he is required to prove his case. He is required to present evidence. And the demeaning of that concept shows how weak the Trump side was. I'm very pleased with an appellate court decision at that level. And I hope when it gets to the merits of the Alien Enemies Act, at least five justices on the Supreme Court will uphold that decision.
One would hope and expect, but well, not expect necessarily, but hope for sure. Well, on Tuesday, and another good decision, I think, and I think you think, a federal judge, a Trump appointee in this case again, threw out the Trump administration's lawsuit, which he had filed against all of the 15 federal district court judges in Maryland. Tell us about that lawsuit. Why did the administration bring it in the first place? And what did they want? And why did the judge rule as the judge did?
You know, the audacity of the Trump administration and the Trump DOJ has no limits. Here they sued every judge sitting in Maryland, claiming that their rulings were biased and unjustified. Therefore, they had to reach out to a judge in Roanoke, Virginia, because all of the judges being sued were recused. And that was Thomas Cullen, a Trump appointee. He wrote a 39-page scathing ruling that said the suit was novel and potentially calamitous, and that the notion of suing all of the judges in a district was unprecedented. But that Trump judge took a few pages to point out that over the past months, several principals of the executive and their spokespersons have described federal judges across the country as left-wing, liberal, activists, radical, politically minded, rogue, unhinged, outrageous, overzealous, and unconstitutional, crooked. He said that although there's tension between branches of government, and that's a hallmark of our constitutional system, quote, this concerted effort by the executive, meaning Trump, to smear and impugn individual judges who rule against it is both unprecedented and unfortunate. I think this is important. It was a slap down to a Hail Mary pass by the DOJ that I remember saying had no reasonable chance of success. But I'm pleased that a Trump judge is lining up with others that are condemning Trump's attacks on the judiciary.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Well, Steve, making headlines over the past few weeks is the GOP-led effort in Texas to redraw their voting districts in order to increase the chance that Republican Congress members will be elected. There's already at least one legal challenge, I understand. So tell us about this. Who is suing? What are the legal claims they're bringing? And what relief are they demanding?
You know, I've said this on our program many times. I'm so impressed by the caliber of the lawyers that are bringing these cases. So within days of Texas passing House Bill 4, the National Redistricting Foundation, on behalf of a coalition of Texas voters, sued to stop that redistricting bill. Now, this was a mid-decade congressional map revision, even though just recently in 2021, in the normal process following a census, Texas had already approved a redistricting bill and had argued elsewhere that it was blind to race and it was a proper redistricting. Now, all of a sudden, because President Trump has asked for five more seats out of Texas, very obligingly, the Republican-controlled legislature passed that bill. This lawsuit will go to a three-judge panel immediately at the district level and is directly appealable to the U.S. Supreme Court. The lawsuit alleges intentionally dismantling proper districts in Houston, Dallas-Fort Worth, Central Texas, and South Texas. Time doesn't permit us to go over how bastardized this map moves the districts around to favor Anglo-preferred candidates and largely Republican candidates. It's a comprehensive lawsuit. It details how this has violated the 14th and 15th Amendments and the Voting Rights Act. It is concrete in its examples of how the gerrymandering is illegal, and they are seeking to restrain the map, to appoint a supervisor over the elections, to ensure that this does not go into effect in the upcoming midterm elections.
Mm-hmm. Well, turning to the subject now, Steve, of freedom of the press, there's been a disturbing development in ICE's detention of a journalist named Mario Guevara. Mr. Guevara has been covering immigration and other law enforcement activity in the Atlanta area for over 20 years now. He was arrested for live streaming law enforcement activity. He's been detained for over 2 months by ICE. What's the story here? How can ICE get away with this? And what are his advocates doing about it?
You know, as much as we talk about those broad lawsuits, and we've had several of them today that are systemic and institutional across the country, it is so important to drill down on these individual cases. Here is Mario Guevara, a Spanish language journalist, actively covering ICE activities and the detention center in Georgia. And he was in the midst of reporting and filming on an ICE raid when ICE officers seized him, arrested him. While they were transporting him, they told him he'd been a headache, but now they could conduct their operations against immigrants without Guevara reporting on them. The habeas corpus petition that has been filed by the American Civil Liberties Union alleged that his continued detention on the basis of his journalism is intended to silence him, prevent him from reporting in the future, and retaliate against him for his past speech and reporting, all in violation of the First Amendment. He was reporting on the No King's Day and other activities. Now, the government, and it's striking what they're willing to openly say, the government argued that that bail that had been granted for him so that they could conduct the legal proceedings without him in custody, they argued for a stay of the bail, of the bond. They insisted, as if this was a crime, that Guevara presents a danger to the community because he films and records law enforcement activities and shares his reporting with the public, unquote. Directly saying the quiet part out loud, that what Guevara is doing is journalism. That's why he was arrested. That's why he's been detained. We're very hopeful the ACLU will win the habeas corpus and that that journalist can be released and returned to protecting the First Amendment.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Wow. Well, Steve, 2 weeks ago, the Ninth Circuit denied the Trump administration's attempt to block certain research grants. This is a really big hot topic lately. The case that I'm thinking of is called Thakur versus Trump, and it was brought by six researchers at the University of California who had been granted funds for their projects and then received notice their funding was rescinded. So tell us about the major issues in this case and why the ruling is so important.
Well, this is now the turning out to be the analog to the Harvard case just decided today. This case was decided on August 21st. A unanimous panel of the Ninth Circuit denied a stay of an injunction that the district court had granted. The district court held a full hearing, and it blocked the cancellation of research grants, and in the process concluded that the cancellation likely violated the First Amendment, that justified an injunction, and now the Ninth Circuit refused to lift that injunction. The plaintiffs in that case were six researchers at the University of California who applied for and received multi-year federal research grants from the Environmental Protection Agency and the National Endowment for the Humanities. But on April 2025, the EPA and the NEH sent form letters to the plaintiffs informing them that their grants were now terminated. The EPA letter said the award no longer effectuates the program goals or agency priorities, and that the objectives of the award are no longer consistent with the EPA funding priorities. Well, that was a lot of legalistic gobbledygook, because the actual orders they were enforcing were, among others, eight executive orders by President Trump seeking to eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion, and diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility. These were openly hostile to those ideologies and forms of teaching. They stated that critical and influential institutions of American society, including the federal government and the institutions of higher education, and this is the Trump executive order speaking, have adopted and actively used dangerous, demeaning, and immoral race or sex-based preferences under the guise of diversity, equity, and inclusion. You know, this is going to the heart of one of the largest battles being fought in America today. The notion that if we are going to counteract centuries of discrimination, of sexism, of prejudice in this country, we need programs that recognize diversity, equity, and inclusion as important policies that need to be followed. And fortunately, the Ninth Circuit, in a unanimous three-judge opinion, said just that. They said that when a government uses invidious viewpoint discrimination, in this case to cancel grants, it violates the First Amendment. They called out the government because what the government is openly doing is aimed at the suppression of what they consider dangerous ideas. And this violates the Constitution. The government cited some cases in this field, but the Ninth Circuit said the government is misreading those cases and is engaging in unconstitutional violations. Fortunately, this lawsuit is an as-applied challenge, so it allowed the petitioners to bring in the evidence of how specific grants that were otherwise entirely appropriate and suitable for government grants, and had in fact, of course, been granted, were being denied and terminated because the Trump administration wants to impose viewpoint discrimination against DEI or even environmental justice viewpoints. Now, the laws the executive orders didn't define those terms, but clearly we all know what they meant, and the court called it for what it was. So they have enjoined the government from terminating those grants, and they cited the bedrock principle that government cannot, quote, leverage its power to award subsidies on the basis of subjective criteria and then turn that into a penalty on disfavored viewpoints or aim at the suppression of so-called dangerous ideas. It's a powerful opinion. I think it will have precedential impact among courts of appeals across the country. I would no doubt expect that it's been cited in the Harvard case. And I do think as a result, we are seeing this solid wall of cases coming in, over 400 lawsuits, 200 injunctions against this court. And the issue is going to remain that when the Supreme Court or the six reactionary justices on the Supreme Court see these kinds of thoughtful, well-analyzed opinions, are they going to have the gall to turn them back when they are based on the Constitution and settled law? That all remains to be seen.
Yes. And I wonder, we just have a couple of minutes left, Steve. First of all, where can people follow your writings? Any other last minute thoughts you want to leave us with?
Well, I'm so grateful for programs like this. And my work is at LA Progressive, Truth Dig. There are gatherings of my work as well. I'm writing now for Ms. Magazine quite extensively, and my Speaking Freely podcast that you were kind enough to mention is now posted with the most important First Amendment cases in the history of the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, excellent. Well, Steve Rohde, again, thank you so much. I know this is not something Steve simply tosses off the top of his brain. He spends a lot of time. We talk about the cases ahead of time, sometimes right up to the last minute. And Steve somehow manages to summarize those cases for us every week, the most important cases that we find coming down from the courts. So it's a time-consuming and brilliant endeavor on his part that he brilliantly handles. So, Steve Rohde, thank you so much for joining us here again on the law. I started to say Law and Disorder, but yes, that's where we all co-host, but on the Lawyers Guild Show, my friend.
Look, it is truly a privilege and a pleasure, and I always end because we were in the streets over Labor Day. There were banner drops across our state.
Yes,
these lawsuits are necessary but not sufficient. Nobody can sit back and say that the lawyers and the judges are going to solve our problems for us. These lawsuits have been critical to create a bulwark and a backstop. But all of us, including our listeners, have to do our part.
Well, thank you again for that, Steve Rohde. We're going to take a very brief station ID break now, and then we're going to be back with you with Matthew Strugar, an animal rights expert. That's a show that we don't get as much opportunity to do as we'd like. And so you want to make sure you stay tuned for that, my friends.
Hi, this is Angelique Kidjo, and you're listening to People Powered Radio, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and worldwide on the web at www.kpfk.org. Peace and love.
And indeed, we are right back with you. It was a short ID break. We're right back with you here on the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm still Jim Lafferty, still with my wonderful co-host, Maria Hall. Maria, why don't you introduce our last topic of the day and our guest for that topic?
Oh, all right then. Well, humankind has happily made some considerable progress in extending legal rights to the non-human animal world. But certainly from the point of view of animal rights activists, we've still got a long way to go. So today on the Lawyers Guild Show, we'll speak with an attorney whose practice includes animal rights law and, of course, human law, because a lot of times the advocates need as many rights as the animals do. So his practice includes animal rights law and civil rights law, human rights law, and he's going to discuss some of the most recent battles to secure legal protection for animals and their advocates. So our guest is attorney Matthew Strugar. Mr. Strugar was previously director of litigation for the PETA Foundation, or People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Matthew Strugar is now in private practice, where in addition to animal law, his practice includes handling civil rights cases, cases of police misconduct, the First Amendment, prisoners' rights, the defense of political protesters, and more. And we are very good friends, long-term comrades, so we're so happy to see Matthew. Welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thanks for having me. Third time guest, I think, over many years.
Yeah. Well, you know, Matthew is kind of an introvert, so we have to, like, get him out, you know, once in a while.
Except in front of a judge.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I wanted to start out with this very broad question, Matthew. Since animal law and animal rights can mean so many different things to different people, can you start us off just by explaining the broad categories of what's covered in there, just so listeners, we're all on the same page?
Sure. I think most people, when they think of animal law, they think of animal protection law, and that's a huge part of animal law. There's kind of three levels of animal protection law. There's the federal level, of course. There's things like the Endangered Species Act, which is thought primarily of protecting wild animals who are under threat of extinction, although it operates in different ways. There's also the Animal Welfare Act at the federal level, which generally sets minimum standards for some animals in laboratories and some animals who are put in exhibition, like at zoos or in circuses. I say some animals because the Animal Welfare Act exempts all rats and mice, and those animals make up more than 95% of animals used in experiments in the United States. At any given time, there's about 110 million rats or mice in U.S. laboratories at any given time. And so they have no protection. You could take a blowtorch to a mouse in a laboratory for fun and it wouldn't have any federal protection. But then on the state level, you generally have animal cruelty laws designed to protect animals. Those operate at most every state. And then certain states have more protective laws. California, which I hope to talk about more later, sets certain standards for space for confining birds and pigs. It bans the sale of things like things that are sold everywhere else in the country, like fur or kangaroo leather or foie gras. And then on the local level, you can have all kinds of cutting edge protections. So West Hollywood, for instance, was the first city in the country to ban declawing of cats, to ban fur sales, to ban the sale of dogs and cats. And those all went on to be state level protections throughout California. And just last week, West Hollywood banned all live animal sales in the city, including rodents, lizards, fish, anybody. So, you know, some really cutting edge stuff coming out at the city levels in California. And so that's an overview of animal protection law generally. Animal law itself tries to use those laws to protect animals in any way that we can. But then we also use other aspects of laws, be it criminal defense, consumer protection, constitutional litigation, or anything else to sort of advance the rights of animals or the people who are trying to protect them in the courts.
Well, yes, and let's look at that second, that last example, you people trying to protect them in the courts. Give us a little historical background on how heavy-handed the government has been, well, in investigating and prosecuting animal rights activists, and how the laws on civil rights and civil liberties factor into that.
Yeah, so throughout the like mid sort of 2000s through the mid 2010s, for that decade there, there was significant federal investigations, prosecutions, and surveillance of animal rights and environmental activists. It's a time period that some people in the movements call the Green Scare, that sort of harkened back to, you know, the Red Scare of the 40s, 1940s. A top FBI official testified at that time to Congress that environmental and animal rights extremists were the number one domestic terror threat that the nation faced. Which might have been surprising for anyone who lived through the mid-2000s.
Yes.
And that was despite neither of those groups ever having taken any human life. So as part of the Green Scare, the federal government prosecuted scores of animal rights and environmental activists, often seeking sentences that lasted decades. And some of those prosecutions were for things like property destruction, like burning down a research facility, looking to introduce genetically modified timber. But other prosecutions were against movement leaders who weren't alleged to have really participated in any illegal activity, but were out there sort of cheering on those who did. So obviously there were some significant First Amendment implications there. There were a lot of fights in the courts. There were some wins. There were more losses than there were wins. But I tend to think that some of the wins that we did have stymied further government overreach. And we just haven't seen those kinds of prosecutions, thankfully, in the last 10 years, at least at the sort of level that we saw them during that period.
Excellent. Excellent.
Wow. Well, I did want to talk about one case that is, it's called the People of the State of California versus Shung. And that began as a criminal case brought against the leader of an animal rights organization. Tell us about this case. Tell us about the underlying facts, as well as why Mr. Shung was being prosecuted and what he's charged with.
Sure. And this is a case that's up on appeal right now, so we don't have a decision, but it raises a lot of interesting issues, and it's got a lot of people watching and interested in it. So Wayne Shung, something of a charismatic leader in a certain segment of the animal rights movement. He co-founded an organization called Direct Action Everywhere that, as maybe the name suggests, is committed to engaging in acts of civil disobedience to save animals. They're often prosecuted for it, which, you know, can maybe kind of be expected. But in this instance, some members of the group marched onto a poultry factory farm, identified birds who were sick or injured, and walked out with them and took them to receive veterinary care. Other members of the group locked themselves to the farm's front gate. Both actions would be actions that almost anybody could have expected to be arrested and prosecuted for. But Mr. Shung didn't do either of those things. Instead, he sort of stood outside on the road with a variety of other supporters who weren't breaking any law. And he said through a megaphone something along the lines of, "We have to support the people who are putting their neck on the line here. If these people need water, give them water. If they need food, give them food. Let them know that you appreciate the sacrifice they are making." And for that, the Sonoma District Attorney's Office sought an indictment and obtained one, and both charged and convicted him for aiding and abetting the trespass of the people who walked onto the farm to save the birds.
Well, and I understand there's an appeal pending that focuses on legal issues, including the First Amendment and also the necessity defense, if I'm right. There's also an amicus brief I know filed by some heavy hitters in support of Mr. Shung. So let's start with the First Amendment issue. How does it play into Mr. Shung's case, and what are the key arguments on both sides in that case?
Sure. So on the First Amendment, the argument is basically that giving a speech supporting a protest or even speech supporting unlawful activity that's happening at that moment is protected. That's sort of the bedrock of the famous Brandenburg versus Ohio case, maybe one of the most important First Amendment cases of the last century, where the Supreme Court said that advocating illegal action can only be prosecuted if it is, one, intended to cause the illegal action, two, likely to cause the illegal action, and three, that the illegal action is imminent, meaning that it's to happen that second, that there's no sort of time for contemplation or thought or advocating for future illegal conduct. So in Mr. Shung's case, the judge gave the jury an instruction saying that it can be aiding and abetting a crime to, quote, promote the crime. Well, what's advocacy if it's not promotion? And you know, it didn't provide the Brandenburg instruction or anything based on it. So that's really the issue that's up on appeal. Is it basically overbroad to say that you can aid and abet a crime by promoting that crime? And so Mr. Shung has some solid amicus support from organizations like the Center for Constitutional Rights, the ACLU of Northern California, and even the National Lawyers Guild on this very issue.
Yes. Excellent, excellent. And when we might, it's going to be some time before we get an outcome in that case, do you think? Or
yeah, the reply brief was recently filed, so we probably have 3 or 4 months to argument and then maybe another couple months to an appeal.
Yes.
But there's another interesting issue there too, and that's on this necessity defense, and I would just want to touch on that
yes,
quickly.
Yes, please do. Please explain what it is, sure. And then, of course, the basic arguments on both sides and where you think it'll go.
Yeah, so the necessity defense is sort of a classic defense to a tort or a crime that says, basically, I might have committed this crime or tort, but I really had no other choice. So the kind of example that they use in law school is sort of a classic example of the necessity defense is you're driving down the road, a semi is coming at you head on in your lane, you swerve onto someone else's property to avoid the head-on collision. So maybe that's technically a trespass, or maybe if you hit somebody's fence, that's technically some kind of trespass to chattel. But you had no other choice, so usually necessity is a defense to those kinds of torts or that kind of crime. And then in the 70s and 80s, this sort of became a popular tool in social justice movements where peace activists would march on the military bases and either try to pour fake blood onto missiles or disarm missiles or whatnot, use the necessity defense to argue that they were doing what they had to do to prevent deaths from war. Animal rights activists over the years have tried to use the necessity defense as well, usually without much success, but sometimes with success. And Mr. Shung tried to use the necessity defense here, arguing that even if promoting was aiding and abetting, that the trespassers, the actual activists who walked onto the farm to save these sick and injured birds, that they were engaged, it was a necessity to save the lives of those birds. And the trial court said no, and it ruled that the necessity defense is limited to saving human life. And the trial court seems to have created that from whole cloth. I think most people would think that if they see a dog roasting in a car on a hot summer day, they could break the car's window to save the dog's life and not be held liable for either a crime or a tort for doing that. But this judge would say that that's a crime with no necessity defense. So that's another interesting, the other big issue for Mr. Shung's appeal that's attracting some attention. And this issue, he got a good bit of amicus support from a group of legal scholars, most but not all of whom are involved in some form of animal law, but they include real heavy hitters like Michael Dorff at Cornell, Martha Nussbaum at University of Chicago, Larry Tribe at Harvard. So it'll be interesting to see how that issue in particular plays out.
Well, another intriguing case I wanted to get into has to do with your thoughts on, well, the question of, quote unquote, what happens when there are laws on the books to protect animals, but no government agency is actually enforcing those laws, close quote. I mean, there was a recent case, for example, on this issue called Karu Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And I understand that the society just had a win in the appeals court on that case. So tell us about the case, what prompted the lawsuit, what are the key legal arguments, and again, what did the court decide?
Sure. I'm really excited about this case, and bear with me because it really does involve some setup and it might not seem that important at first, but then I'll talk about why the implications for it are very important.
Sure.
So the general setup is that California has some really progressive animal protection laws, at least as compared to other states. But absolutely no one in government has any interest in enforcing these laws. Like I said earlier, California prohibits the sale of leather made from kangaroos. It prohibits the sale of fur products. It prohibits the sale of foie gras, among other things. And while the law itself sometimes gets the heavy hitters out of the California market, like Amazon or the big department stores actually, you know, follow the law because they're big corporations, some of the smaller mom and pop shops or, you know, even some of the bigger corporations just sort of flout the law and say, well, nobody's enforcing it. We can continue to go about doing this. So if the authorities won't enforce the law and there's no provision in any of these laws that allows a private party to bring a lawsuit, how do we get enforcement? And I think that's where these Societies for the Protection of Animals or SPCAs come in. Now, most people think of SPCAs generally as the groups that run animal shelters and the like, and some do that. But the California Corporations Code lets anyone form an SPCA. It's just a certain type of corporation you can form in California. And the corporations code that applies to SPCAs has a provision that says SPCAs, quote, may proffer a complaint against any person before any court or magistrate having jurisdiction for the violation of any law relating to or affecting animals. And this law has been on the books for a long time, but it was a little moribund. Not a whole lot of people were trying to use it or really like testing it out. But some enterprising attorneys at the Animal Legal Defense Fund, which is sort of the leading animal law public interest law firm, took a look and decided to try it out. This case was litigated by one of their younger lawyers, who's sort of an up-and-coming star in the field, Christina Cladis. And so the factual setup for the actual case is that there was a woman in Solano County who was running this dog breeding business in her backyard, and she was just hoarding these dogs. Dozens of them. And sometimes they would get loose and terrorize the town. And this SPCA decides they want to do something about it. So they come to ALDF, and together with ALDF, they file this complaint under the Corporations Code saying she was violating all these applicable laws that apply to dog breeders. And the dog breeder comes in the court and says, no, only prosecutors can file these kinds of cases. We can't just be deputizing SPCAs to come in and file lawsuits for anything that they want to file on that the law doesn't otherwise allow. And they basically said that the authorization in the corporation's code to file a complaint meant they could complain to the DA, but the DA had to be the one, the district attorney, but the DA had to be the one to do something about it. Mm-hmm. But earlier this summer, the First District Court of Appeal rejected that argument and said there's no basis in the corporation's code textually to find that that authorization is limited to criminal complaints. And so if it's not so limited, the SPCAs can come in and file complaints seeking to enforce, quote, any law relating to or affecting animals, which is really broad. And it was originally an unpublished decision. The Animal Legal Defense Fund asked the court to publish it, saying that it is the first sort of court to really analyze this section of the Corporations Code and find this sort of private right of action for these SPCAs. And then just last month, they published the decision, meaning it's precedent for the whole state. And so while this was a case of something of a small-time dog breeder, I think the legal implications here could be huge. And those legal implications are playing out in a different case right now, where a different SPCA represented by a different advocacy organization is suing a chicken farm up north for violations of animal cruelty law involving the conditions those chickens live in. Mm-hmm. And the defendant in that case is running around screaming like their hair's on fire over this idea that the SPCA can just come in and file these cases. So when the trial court allowed the case to continue by overruling a demurrer, which is basically like a motion to dismiss in the state trial level, they sought an emergency writ to the Court of Appeal. And then all these big animal agricultural groups like the Cattlemen's Association and the Farm Bureau and the Poultry Federation came in as amicus and said, now listen, the sky is going to fall if you just allow these kinds of cases to continue. Just allow these SPCAs to sue to enjoin animal cruelty anytime there's not animal cruelty. I mean, basically what they're saying is, you know, we might have regulatory capture from the DAs because we're powerful businesses, but we can't control these SPCAs. And, you know, we're a big corporation and we need that kind of control. And I think just by luck of timing, this other case involving this dog breeder, the Karu case, should set the precedent that applies statewide, and these other cases should be allowed to continue. So it might kind of light a path for enforcement for all of these good laws that are just sitting there being flouted, because if SPCAs are willing to step up, you know, we don't need to rely on prosecutors or health departments or whoever else is supposed to enforce these laws. The SPCAs can just come directly to court to get an injunction saying, hey, these corporations, these big these big corporations profiting off of animal suffering, you know, you have to knock it off.
Question, wow. Quick question. Sure. Are there any attorney's fees provisions that play into this?
Great question. Not explicitly, but 1021.5 is sort of the general public interest fee shifting statute in California. It's discretionary, but it's often granted. And so there's no reason that I'm aware of that 1021.5 fees couldn't apply. But to be honest, none of these cases have gotten that far yet where there are any requests for attorney's fees. But that was also one of my thoughts in looking at all of this is, you know, maybe not only is this an enforcement mechanism, it might be a self-funded enforcement mechanism, which is an even more powerful kind of enforcement mechanism if you don't have to pay tens or twenties or thirties of thousands of dollars to prosecute these cases if you could get that money, you know, if you're successful on the back end.
That's right. Well, Matthew, so thank you so much for all this. But I'm also interested in some broader issues that I suspect you could help us with a bit. You've mentioned you've been on from time to time over the years. Once upon a time in this country, it varies from period to period. You'll see more or less discussion of animal rights. Sometimes you seem to hear about the cases all the time, then a period of time will go through your hearing list. There's so much other news going on these days that I suppose it's not surprising that we don't hear, and which is why we should be doing this more often, frankly, on the Lawyers Guild show. But what is your assessment of where the animal rights movement stands from a legal point of view today? Forget just California, but with nationwide, have we made significant progress in terms of the laws, in terms of the lawsuits and the decisions coming out of those lawsuits, are we pretty much still back in a primitive time, even though we've talked a lot about animal rights?
I think like a lot of things in this country, we had a lot of, you know, progress that we might have taken for granted for the first part of this century, and that the pendulum is swinging back, unfortunately. There were some, you know, recent wins, even as far as up in the Supreme Court in defending California's right to pass laws saying not only can you not raise animals in certain conditions in California, you can't sell into California, the largest market in the country, if your farms don't comply with these laws. And so there are all kinds of challenges under the Dormant Commerce Clause and whatever else. And we've had a very close but great decision, I don't know, about 4 or 5 years back, and saying that California was within its rights to have those kinds of laws. I think if a law like that went up now, we'd likely be looking at a different outcome. I think just as like a movement generally, I think unfortunately, it's sort of on the downswing. The grassroots activists I know say they see a lot fewer younger people coming into the movement, which is always a bad sign for any social movement. You need the young people. Yeah. But I think these things ebb and flow, and you know, you just have to stay committed to your principles and keep your eyes on the prize and try to bring people along and forge alliances. One thing that I do sort of like of the last maybe 8 to 10 years is that there's a lot more attempts from animal rights activists to forge alliances with the broader left. So just this week, this group that Mr. Shung was a part of has been running a campaign against Trader Joe's for selling a certain farm's chickens and turkeys. And they teamed up with the nascent Trader Joe's Union, Trader Joe's United or something like that, to join the campaign against Trader Joe's selling this particular thing. And sort of when the farmer John Plant in Vernon was shutting down in 2021 and 2022 because of COVID, and the workers were out on strike. There were actual animal rights activists who were holding demos outside of that same slaughterhouse on a weekly basis, who, you know, approached the union and said, you know, how can we help, you know, your fight for more humane conditions and better pay at these places? So that's the kind of thing you probably wouldn't have seen 20 years ago, unfortunately. But fortunately now, they're trying to forge these broader movements with workers and other social justice issues to try to build those alliances, you know, across social justice movements.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering also, you know, you mentioned at the top of the show, I forget, there was an astonishing figure in the millions or whatever it was of the number of rats and mice that are used in medical experiments in the country. Has there been no effort or movement on the part of research, medical research, to try to find other ways of developing the medicines they develop, or in some cases, simply the cosmetics that are being developed, without the use of and sacrifice of animals?
Yeah, it's a really tough issue. I mean, cosmetic testing is less and less, but just as far as medical testing, it's not. It's larger than ever. And it's largely a function, and this gets a little tricky because you start getting into sort of, frankly, Trumpy kind of arguments. But the incentive really is that the money for this for research, for this kind of biomedical research, comes from NIH. And so there are all kinds of studies that are just replicating things that people already know, that people have already done over and over again, because that's where the research money comes in. Mm-hmm. So you apply for this money and the NIH grants it. Whereas if it was, you know, I'm not trying to say private industry is the solution and government funding is not, but in this case, it might be, you know, no private company would be wasting, you know, millions of dollars in, frankly, millions and millions of animals' lives to redo experiments that they've done 100 times before if they were repaying their own money to do it. But because of the way that the NIH gives out grants and the way that medical research is funded in this country, it sort of encourages sort of a maximalist approach to both using animals and redoing research that's frankly been done before.
Mm-hmm. And what about if you were somehow... Well, I mean, I know the answer to the question, so let me ask the question differently than I was going to. If there is one area in the field of animal rights today, and I know there are many that need new laws, new advancement, new ways of thinking on the part of the public in terms of what we choose to eat and what we choose to have as pets and how we consider our pets and, you know, the fact that we consider them pets. All of that is going on. If there was one particular area of animal rights law and public policy and human understanding that was most important of all to try to make changes in, what might it be, do you think?
I think, unfortunately, it's the sort of the classic thing people think of when they think of animal rights activists, which is it's what we eat. I mean, more animals, there's more animal suffering on farms and be that factory or otherwise farms. In this country and in the world than there is in labs or that there is in roadside zoos or that there is in anything else. I mean, all those things involve a lot of animal suffering, but the scale of it for the production of animals killed for meat or raised for their eggs or raised for their milk is substantially higher. So, you know, I don't know what law could come in there, but for most people just sort of trying to eat a little lower down in the food chain whenever you can, no. I think would make a great difference.
Well, we are now, frankly, out of time. Matthew Strugar, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
How do people follow your work very quickly? Do you have a...
Or I have a website. It doesn't get updated very often. It's my name, MatthewStrugar.com. But to follow animal law generally, look to the leaders in the field, that be Animal Legal Defense Fund or Advancing Law for Animals or some of these other groups. Their websites are often updated with more exciting case updates.
Well, no, you've been very wonderful for us here today. We thank you for joining us. Until next week at the same time, that's all we have today for our listeners. We thank you all for listening. This is Jim Lafferty on behalf of myself and Maria Hall, urging you to stay healthy, try to stay cool in this weather, and by all means, make sure you continue to stand up for your rights, my friends.
Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. Life is really worth. It's
your right.
Support comes from CAP UCLA presenting Arturo O'Farrell and the Afro-Latin Jazz Ensemble on Friday, October 3rd at the Nemoy. Led by pianist and composer O'Farrell, the Grammy-winning group brings their signature vibrant, spirited performance style and sounds steeped in Latin jazz traditions to the stage. Further information and tickets are available at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.